From the John K. Perlage Courtroom at the St. Louis University School of Law in downtown St. Louis, welcome to St. Louis on the Air and our legal roundtable discussion. I'm Don Marsh. I'd like to welcome our audience to the courtroom today. Give yourselves a round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. We are looking for full participation from you today. The first Monday in October, that's October 7th this year, is the traditional starting point for the annual U.S. Supreme Court term. That means there's history in the making, with major decisions likely on such issues as affirmative action, campaign financing, and the president's ability to make certain appointments. There are other issues not related to the Supreme Court, including a ruling on Facebook and free speech from a lower court. And here in St. Louis, judges turn thumbs down on a proposal to establish a gun court. But the Missouri governor's veto of a controversial gun bill stands. Lots to talk about with our panel of attorneys. Bill Freivogel is director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. Mark Smith is assistant vice chancellor at Washington University and director of the Career Center there. Also joining us is Joel Goldstein, the Vincent C. Immel Professor of Law at St. Louis University School of Law. We'll be taking questions from our studio audience and via email at talk@stlpublicradio.org and, of course, on Twitter. We're unable to take phone calls today. Again, thank you all so much for being with us. I'd like to start with Joel Goldstein, if I may. Joel, what kind of a term do you think we can expect from the Supreme Court this year, given the known docket, the players, and past performance?
Well, I think that listening to you describe some of the cases that are on the term, I mean, in one sense, it has some of the flavor of round up the usual suspects. I mean, there's an affirmative action case, there's an abortion case, there's a campaign finance case. There are also some interesting cases dealing with presidential power and some more sort of esoteric cases dealing with the treaty power. The court in the constitutional level has been divided between two blocks with Justice Kennedy in the middle. On the other hand, the court has really shown a lot of agreement on non-constitutional cases. Even the justices who disagree the most end up agreeing about 60% of the time, and in about close to 50% of the cases are 9-0 decisions. So that there's a lot of consensus on the court, even though in some of the marquee cases there's a lot of 5-4 decisions.
Bill Freivogel, what will you be looking for?
Well, as Joel said, in to a certain extent, the docket looks a lot like it has topics on it that are a lot like ones that have been on the docket for the last 40 years. When we think about school prayer, abortion, affirmative action, racial discrimination. I once had a wise editor who told me that in writing news articles about the Supreme Court, that you should very seldom use, if ever, use the term landmark, because in the time frame of a daily newspaper, you probably can't be sure that it's going to stand for the decades or for the ages. I think it's still probably safe to say the last two terms of the court had landmark decisions when you think about the upholding Obamacare, throwing out the Defense of Marriage Act, and maybe even the Voting Rights, throwing out the Voting Rights Act, which was the most effective civil rights case, civil rights statute in history. I think that if you look at this, I don't think we'll have a landmark decision on that order this year, this term. Although, you know, I could be proven wrong. If you look at the cases before the court, I think there's a good chance that we'll have more conservative, you know, using that term sort of advisedly, results. I think the court could well open the door to more acknowledgement of prayer in public spaces, allow state voters to ban affirmative action, and open up the political process to even more money.
Okay, Mark Smith, and your turn.
I would agree with that, because in the last few years we've had the big cases Bill talked about, but also the guns case, that's going to be in con law textbooks for a while. The Citizens United case was a big, big case. And I think this year I don't see any really big cases. One possible exception is that Klein case out of Oklahoma. It's an abortion rights case. It probably won't be a big deal, but it could be, because Justice Kennedy's a swing vote. He seems willing to maybe rethink Roe versus Wade, and if that to me is the one case that could be, has potential to be the huge case of the term. But it also might be, they've sent it back to Oklahoma saying, well, tell us some more facts, and it may or may not even go forward.
Okay, well, let's start with questions from the audience, because the next issue I was going to bring up is one that Dean H., who is a student here at St. Louis University Law School, will do for me. Go ahead, Dean.
Yes, my name is Dean. I'm a 3L here at SLU Law. My question was, Chief Justice John Roberts seems particularly concerned about upholding the legitimacy of the Supreme Court and the views of the Supreme Court as a legitimate body, as opposed to sort of a politically polarized body. Do you see this trend continuing through this term, and do you see it as any kind of response to how polarized Congress has become in the last two decades?
I think he's being he respects the court and its tradition, and he wants to not undercut the legitimacy of the court. And I think you've seen him be kind of careful in some decisions. So even like the voting rights case that came down last year, there was a case, 4 years before, where they basically said, hey, Congress, do something or we're going to overturn this. And Congress didn't do anything, which is kind of what Congress is doing now. And so they stepped in. So I think he sees that as modest step forward. But then you've got Ginsburg saying that she thinks the Roberts Court is the most activist court. Now, I don't know that I think that's true when you look at the actual number of cases they've overturned. But I think he's trying to be modest trying to maintain the court's reputation.
I think the premise of your question is right. I think the Chief Justice is very concerned about the court's institutional position, and he has a big stake in it. I mean, his name is on the court. Even if Justice Kennedy is often the deciding vote in some of the contested cases, I mean, in the 5-4 decisions, Justice Kennedy's in the majority 90-some percent of the time. But the Chief Justice's name is on the court. And beyond that, I think he's also a very good and experienced lawyer and somebody who has a sense of the court historically. And so I think, for instance, in the last term, one of the things you see is that the court is writing fewer opinions, that there are fewer dissents and fewer concurrences. And I think that probably reflects some effort on the part of the Chief Justice to have the court speak with fewer voices, even when it can't speak with one voice. I think if you think about the case last term, the Fisher case, the affirmative action case, there you had a majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy, but basically one that Justice Sotomayor and Justice Breyer signed on to, even though it weakened the Grutter case that they had joined, 9 years earlier. So, again, I think that suggests some sort of effort on his part, on other people's part, to try and find agreement where they can.
I would agree also that with the premise of your question that I think Chief Justice Roberts is very interested in maintaining the legitimacy of the court, and he has a huge stake in it. He's a very young Chief Justice. The Roberts Court could last another 20 or 30 years. And I think that may account. I mean, justices never like to say that they're making any decisions based on strategic or political reasons. But, Roberts sort of famously said he just calls balls and strikes. But I think if you're realistic about it, that probably in the Obamacare decision, he most likely joined the more liberal members of the court to uphold Obamacare under the tax portion of the Constitution, the tax power of the Constitution. Because he didn't want to be part of a 5 Republican justice-appointed majority striking down the biggest social welfare legislation of a Democratic president in 30 years. Because I think he thought that would hurt the legitimacy of the court. I think this past, Joel mentioned the affirmative action case. I think this past term, they had the opportunity to basically throw out affirmative action. They didn't do that. And that almost seemed like they made it harder to justify affirmative action in colleges, but they didn't throw it out entirely. And I think that sort of set them up then for the next day or 2 days later for them to throw out the Voting Rights Act, and that looked like they were entirely dismantling civil rights protections.
Before we discuss the affirmative action case, will be before the court this time. I heard something on NPR earlier today on the Diane Rehm show. I'd just like to get your impression. And basically, a law professor from Washington was saying that he detects an intellectual power struggle going on between Elena Kagan and John Roberts. That struggle would be who would be the most influential ultimately on the court. Does that make any sense to any of you gentlemen? Joel?
I think You know, in the sense that they're both, I mean, two of the more imposing intellects on the court.
Yeah.
And they also both, I mean, if you look at the opinions that different people write, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kagan are the two that give the most sort of appearance of trying to write opinions in a way that any of us can understand and can relate to. And so I think from that standpoint, I think there may be something to it. I mean, really, in the marquee cases, Justice Kagan tends to agree with Justice Ginsburg. I mean, that's the highest agreement rate. They agree on overall on 96% of the time. So she really needs, in order to compete with the Chief Justice in terms of building majorities, she really needs to reach out to Justice Kennedy. And I don't know how successful she's really been in doing that.
Any other thoughts?
I mean, I guess I would think that to say it's an intellectual power struggle between the two of them is simplistic. There's an awful lot of other people who on the court who think that they're pretty smart and try to demonstrate it frequently. Justice Scalia comes to mind. Justice Sotomayor doesn't keep very quiet either. And Breyer, I think, certainly would say that he has what it takes to be the intellectual strength of the moderate to liberal wing of the court.
And even though Ginsburg is a quieter person, I mean, she's giving interviews saying, I'm the leader of the left and that they're two activists. So, yeah.
All right. Well, we have that other affirmative action case before the court this time. Who would like to explain what's going on here and its significance?
I could talk a little bit about it. This is the Schuette case. He's the Attorney General of Michigan. And so a lot of the affirmative action cases, the big one, the Grutter case, came out of Michigan. And that was,
2003.
Yeah, 2003, so about 10 years ago. And basically, in reaction to that, there was a voter-led initiative for something called Proposal 2, which basically banned affirmative action in Michigan, similar to what happened in California a few years ago. And California, the measure was contested. It was upheld by the Ninth Circuit. The Michigan initiative was contested, and the Sixth Circuit, the Court of Appeals that includes Michigan, struck it down. And it was kind of, they didn't strike it down saying you can't limit affirmative action. They have this theory called political structure theory, and it basically was saying, because now if I want to get some, if I'm an athlete and I want to have the University of Michigan schools give some kind of preference for athletes, I can go to the admissions people, I can go to the regents of the school, and I can make my case. But if I want to have some preference based on race, now the only thing I can do is I've got to go out and organize and have some big initiative. And that's not fair. And there are two cases, but the cases are old. They're like 20 years old, where townships would ban, say, well, if you want to do a particular kind of law, you have to have it passed by the whole electorate. And they were saying, we're not going to allow that. So that's kind of the background. It's not, the Fisher case was the one from Texas last year that everyone talks about. It's interesting that Fisher is not really even mentioned in this Michigan case. I predict what will happen. Kagan's out of this case as well. So it'll be up to Kennedy. I think there's a good chance they'll just kind of say that this doesn't either come up within that political process strand of equal protection, or they'll just kind of do away with it. What do you guys think?
Well, the Sixth Circuit decision was a closely divided case that struck down the Michigan constitutional amendment under the political restructuring doctrine that Mark mentioned. And I think, as Mark points out, the cases that have articulated that doctrine are old, and the most recent one, I think, was in the early 1980s, and that itself was a 5-4 decision in which the four conservatives were on the losing side. I think that the difference here in this case and the Fisher case is that Fisher raised, and Grutter and the other affirmative action cases have raised the issue of whether or not a race-conscious admissions plan violated the Constitution. But the court has never said that there's a constitutional right to have a race-conscious admissions plan. What Michigan has tried to do by by constitutional amendment is to, in effect, make it very difficult for any state institution in Michigan to take race or gender into account in making decisions. And I would guess that the court's going to leave that to the political process, maybe overturn one of the earlier political restructuring cases.
No, I agree. I think they will let the Michigan voters say they don't want affirmative action in the Michigan public education system and other parts of the government. One thing that strikes me about affirmative action is that how the court has almost been in the same place for 40 years. I'm old enough to remember the Bakke case from 1978, and ever since then, the court has basically said affirmative action is okay in a really narrow circumstance in higher education. It's okay to create diversity if the university thinks they need to create, they have a compelling reason to have more diversity within their university, and it has to be really narrowly tailored. It can be just like it can be one of many pluses. You can't put a number to it. And so they just each time they've come through from Bakke, and then we keep mentioning Grutter, this 10-year-old Michigan case. They said, well, you know, like in Bakke, it's got to be real narrow, and you can't put a number to it, and it has to be really narrowly tailored. And now this last year, and what we have called the Fisher case from Texas, they said, yeah, and we really mean it about how narrow it's got to be, and you got to look at it again to make sure you really need to have affirmative action in order to have diversity. So they just keep tightening it a little bit, but they still leave it in the Constitution.
A lot of people in this country have lost faith with the legal system over decisions such as affirmative action and voting rights and others that we could probably name. And Bob E. from our audience wants to address that subject. Bob, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I'm losing my faith in the American legal system. Huge money interests are giving legislatures the format for laws that help them. And then the legislature is passing the laws, and the courts, especially the Supreme Court, seems to support the corporate interest and not, as the preamble to the Constitution says, to promote the general welfare, ensure domestic tranquility, form a more perfect union. I don't understand, just as a common citizen, how the court can define money as free speech, a militia as an individual, a corporation as a person. I don't see how they can take and change the basis for eminent domain, where a government entity can take away a person's property and give it to another person, not the government. I don't understand how they can eviscerate the Voting Rights Act. I was a military man for many years, and I fought for people in other countries to have the right of self-determination. And I see an activist court eviscerating the right of self-determination for people.
Bob, thank you so much for the question. I'm sure the panel appreciates the fact that you've given them an easy one. Who wants to start with the many points that Bob raised?
Well, I would just say there's been an empirical study recently by a woman, Lee Epstein. She's on the faculty at Northwestern, used to be at WashU, that kind of supports what you said. She goes through and tries to do a study to see if the Roberts Court is favoring corporations, and according to her, they are. I think, you know, some of those cases are complicated, like most cases. And so the eminent domain, you make a decision about whether the government can do this to give to private citizens for the public good would be the argument. We still have the chance to kind of change our legislators. And we've talked about this before. You know, the president, that's one of the most important things, and it's one of the things that never gets talked about, is the president appoints the Supreme Court. We have, how old is Ginsburg now?
She's
80. She's, in good health, but has not been in good health in the past. She's made it clear she's not going to step down. And so the next presidential election, you know, we're talking about all these cases where Kennedy is a swing vote. It could go either way with somebody coming down.
Well, your question is really hard. And, you know, if it were on an essay test and I had a choice whether to answer it, I wouldn't answer it. but and so maybe I should just have been quiet. But it's interesting that amongst the cases you cite, I mean, most of them would be ones where the for lack of a better term, more conservative wing of the court would have been predominant. There, I'm talking about Citizens United, the campaign finance case that you alluded to, the guns. You can have a gun, Second Amendment right to have a gun to protect yourself in the home. But then on the other hand, the eminent domain case, that was a liberal majority. So it's not like there's a single kind of activating political philosophy that they're trying in those cases to put into effect. And even liberal justices in the past have equated free money, campaign finance, campaign money with free speech. So that's something that's not entirely the construct of the conservative justices on the court. So it's just very complicated. I would say your overall point about corporations generally doing well before the Roberts Court is probably true. And I think Chief Justice Roberts has a number of items he's trying to check off of his constitutional wish list as he goes along, and he's just trying to do it at a very sort of even pace so that he doesn't arouse too much opposition.
Before we take a break, while we're talking about campaign finance, there is an issue before the court this time. It's the first big case dealing with this since Citizens United. And while Citizens United dealt with basically with corporations and unions, this one deals with the individual donations, does it not? And what's the significance of this one here?
Yes, well, this is FCC versus McCutcheon, and it deals with a part of the campaign finance law you don't hear about too much. It's what are called the aggregated limits, which means that a single individual can only give a certain amount of money to all the candidates over an election cycle. So, for example, I think the limit is somewhere around $130,000 over this next two-year election cycle that an individual can give to candidates, to party committees, and political committees. What we always hear about is, okay, there are hard limits that individuals can give to a candidate. I think it's $2,600 per election. So we hear about that, and those are constitutional. Then we hear a lot about Citizens United, which is unlimited corporate union money can be used on behalf of a candidate. You can't give it to the candidate, but you can buy a bunch of airtime for to support the candidate. So that's Citizens United. This aggregated limits thing is sort of in between. It's a fellow from Alabama, a businessman who likes to – I mean, he's sort of their Rex Singfield, for lack of a better comparison. A libertarian likes to support Republican causes, and he thinks he should be able to exceed this $133,000 limit and back a whole bunch of candidates whom he favors and committees as well.
So the ruling could be people are people too, huh?
People are people too. I mean, I think most people think that most likely the court, the same five justices as were in the majority in Citizens United, will be in the majority here to say we're not going to have aggregate limits. And the big question is, and this gets into sort of a fine point of constitutional law, will they change the test for judging whether or not campaign finance laws are constitutional? So if they change it to what's called strict scrutiny, which means there has to be a compelling government interest and the law has to be narrowly tailored to meet that government interest, that is a standard they apply to some areas, and hardly any laws can succeed, can pass that really hard strict scrutiny test. If they say that's the test in campaign finance, then probably those hard limits we were talking about before, the $2,600 limits to individual candidates, those could be in jeopardy in some future case.
Go ahead, by all means, Joe.
What the court has said since the Buckley versus Vallejo decision in the mid-1970s is that, in essence, is that Congress can regulate and can limit the amount that somebody contributes to a candidate, but they can't limit the amount that you spend independently to express your views with respect to an election. And so what the aggregate limits do is say, in effect, that if you give the maximum to each candidate, you can contribute to 9 candidates, but you can't contribute to a 10th. You can contribute to 4 PACs, but you can't contribute to a 5th or 6th or 7th. So the issue really is in part, is whether the court will view this as a limit on contributions or whether they'll view it as a limit on expenditures. If they view it as a limit on expenditures, then they're likely to strike it down. And, of course, 3 members of the court, Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy, have said that they think that there shouldn't be any distinction between contribution limits and expenditure limits. They would strike down any contribution limits. So I think the position that the Chief Justice and Justice Alito take is likely to be important here.
I've got to take a break now, but let me encourage members of our audience here. If you have questions, hold up your cards. We'll collect them and get to them during the second part of this broadcast. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our legal roundtable discussion today with panelists Joel Goldstein of St. Louis University, Bill Freivogel of SIU in Carbondale, and Mark Smith of Washington University, all attorneys, obviously. Let's go back to our audience for questions. And Sandy H., go ahead. It's your turn.
Hello. Bill, you made a really intriguing comment, as you often do, about Justice Roberts having a constitutional wish list. So I'd like to hear more about what else you think is on that wish list, and then if Mark and Joel agree that there's an overarching strategy for him in each of these cases to build a new framework.
That's another question on the essay test I'd like to skip. I'll try to answer it. I think deregulation of political money has been on his wish list, and Citizens United was the first step, and that this McCutcheon case from Alabama could be a second step. I think the Voting Rights Act, the way it was set up when he became Chief Justice, was on his wish list of things to get rid of, and I think he was very patient in the way he did it. As I think it was Mark said, that the first time it came up and people thought he was going to read a part of the Voting Rights Act out, he did not. They managed to not have a decisive opinion. Even in the opinion last year, people thought they were going to throw out Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires preclearance of voting changes in particular mostly southern states. Instead, they said, well, no, the formula for figuring who's covered by Section 5 is outdated. Congress can fix it if they want. So that's sort of like softened the appearance of the result, but it was still, it had the same effect as this Congress isn't going to fix anything. And so I think that's another part. It might be, I don't know exactly where he is on religion, but there is a case I think we're going to talk about that we haven't talked about yet that's before the court is on legislative prayers at this one. This one's at a city council meeting, and that certainly has the prospect for allowing for getting rid of the so-called endorsement test that's been used in the past for figuring out if there's a violation of separation of state. In other words, that the government shouldn't be seen as endorsing religion or any particular religion. And so this case involves a little town in New York that has a legislative prayer at the beginning of every session. And most of the prayers were given by Protestant ministers, although not all, and whether or not that's constitutional. Now, a number of years ago, the Supreme Court upheld prayers by paid legislative chaplains. I believe it was in the Nebraska legislature as one of the many ceremonial deisms that are permitted. I think they will uphold the prayer. I don't know why I'm making all these predictions because it's very stupid to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do, but I think they probably will uphold the prayer. The question is, will they use this case is this part of his wish list, and will they use it to throw out the endorsement test, which Sandra Day O'Connor was really very influential in authoring, really.
Joel or Mark, do you want to add or amend anything to that? Otherwise, we'll move on.
I'll just say I think two other areas. I think affirmative action is something he wants to undo. He kind of sees race shouldn't be an issue at all, and you can agree or disagree, but that's his view. And I think also the Commerce Clause, cutting back on it. I mean, that was the brilliance of the Obamacare decision was he upholds Obamacare, but he undercuts the Commerce Clause, which that's been the basis for most of the legislation coming out of Congress. And you know, kind of when I was in law school, the Commerce Clause covered everything, and this cutting back on it. But I also think, I mean, I think all the Supreme Court justices probably have an agenda like this. They have a view of what the law should be like, and they're probably thinking, if I can get one more vote, then I could do this. It's not like being on a court of appeals where you got to follow the Supreme Court. You follow the previous decisions, but you if you're more brilliant than the previous Supreme Court justice, which I'm sure they all think they are, then we can correct these past mistakes and put it right. And that's how they view it. I'm sure Clarence Thomas views his view has always been right. It's just starting to get some traction now.
I think the one category that I might add to those that have been mentioned is abortion. I think that that's an issue where I would think that if Chief Justice Roberts had been on the court in 1973, he would have voted. He'd have been a dissenter in Roe versus Wade. I think, you know, Chief Justice Roberts politically is a very conservative person. He cut his teeth really in the Reagan and the first Bush administration. I think in terms of his approach to how the Constitution should be interpreted, he tends to be pretty conservative. So that, for instance, most of these cases that have recognized new rights, whether it's the right of a woman to terminate a pregnancy or the right of people of the same sex to engage in intimate relations, those are substantive due process cases. I think Chief Justice Roberts tends to not view substantive due process as being a very broad category. I think that there's two factors that would cause Chief Justice Roberts to go more slowly than, say, Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas might. One is that I think that because of his institutional association with the court, the fact that he's the Chief Justice and the fact that he has a long time horizon, he can afford to be more incremental in the changes. And so that in a number of these areas, I think his approach has been to make minor cutbacks rather than to swing for the seats. And then I think the other thing is that temperamentally, he tends not to be as ideological as Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas. I mean, they've pretty much committed themselves in a lot of cases to a form of originalism that tends to be pretty rigid. The Chief Justice is more flexible in his approach, as I think is Justice Alito.
Commerce Clause issue in the ACA case. I've been really interested in the spending authority question in the ACA case because most of our health care regulation is done through Medicare spending authority. And I wondered if any of you read the Medicaid expansion part of the ACA case as a signal that Justice Roberts and the court might want to narrow or pull back that federal authority.
Well, I mean, they certainly put a limit on that spending authority. I mean, yeah, I think it's really important to bring that up in connection with the rest of that decision. So you have Roberts giving the Obama administration the victory for going ahead with the plan, but meanwhile, doctrinally, they take away two of Congress's most powerful greatest powers, the Commerce Clause, you know, which has been used in all sorts of areas, like including the justified civil rights legislation, and then the spending power, which is, you know, that the government can put conditions. If they're going to give you money, they can put conditions on it. And what the conservatives on the court succeeded in doing is saying that that's not a limitless power. There's some place that is going where the government's putting too many is really coercive, the way the government is putting the conditions on the use of the money. So yeah, I think that was very significant.
Donna, you know, people should know that this question is coming from Professor, former Dean, former Provost Sandra Johnson, who is one of the leading health law scholars in the country. So she really should be answering the question that she's asking. When we were on the faculty together, she would do this to me all the time, ask the toughest questions, make the best comments at workshops and so forth. But I think yes. I mean, I think the Sibelius decision, the spending part of that decision really was a big deal. And I think that it's the first time that the court had struck down a condition that had been imposed on us on a spending, and so it does signal a more activist approach. I think the other area that was significant in Sibelius really was the necessary and proper clause. I think that what was done on the Commerce Clause wasn't as significant, but the necessary and proper clause really comes up in all sorts of areas, and so I think both of those were really significant.
I'm going to ask Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer to sign Sandy up for a future program, because this issue is going to be around for a while, I'm sure. Sandy, thank you so much. I'd like to get to a couple of issues that resonate in this area. I have an email here from John in St. Louis County. He says, opponents of the recently vetoed gun rights bill in Missouri say it is a violation of the Supremacy Clause, but that is never said about recent laws in other states legalizing marijuana and other drugs. What's the difference?
The difference is that the laws in other states that legalized marijuana simply said, and I'm speaking broadly because I haven't personally reviewed all of these, but in essence, they simply said that it doesn't violate state law to possess marijuana. Even though it might violate federal law, it doesn't violate state law. But they didn't interfere with the enforcement of federal laws with respect to drugs. The Missouri law that the governor vetoed with respect to gun possession not only would have declared Missouri law, but it would have interfered with the federal enforcement of gun laws that have been on the books for 80 years or since 1934 or 1968 that deal with would regulate guns like machine guns and guns that were that were used with associated with mob activity, and it would have assessed penalties against federal agents who tried to enforce federal law. That, it seems to me, is sweeping and goes further, I think, even than the position of the southern states in the 1950s when they resisted the implementation of Brown versus Board of Education. This really is a challenge to the Supremacy Clause, which is part of the Constitution, and it's part of the Constitution that every member of the state legislature has to swear that he or she will uphold as part of their oath of office.
That bill was truly extraordinary. I mean, it even created a cause of action for, say, a drug dealer who was arrested by a St. Louis police officer with an assault rifle that violated federal gun laws. If the police officer tried to go to the U.S. attorney to get a prosecution, the drug runner with the gun could have sued the police officer. Another part of the bill actually had a provision that said if you name a person who owns a gun, that's a crime, which would have meant, since we all know that the Governor Nixon owns a gun because he's been pictured with a gun, that you couldn't use the name of the governor of Missouri in any published, you know, not only could you not say that Nixon has a gun, you could not use the name Jeremiah Nixon. That bill was extraordinarily it was extraordinary.
Before we take another question from the audience, while we're talking about guns, I just want to bring up the issue of gun courts, which we have talked about frequently on this program. As most people know, I'm sure the circuit judges have decided against establishing a gun docket. The mayor wants it, the circuit attorney wants it, the prosecuting attorney wants it, the police chief wants it. Can the judges be sidestepped on this? I'm sure they can, can't they?
Well, I think they could, but I think Jennifer Joyce has suggested it, she supports it, but she says I'm only supporting it if the judges. I mean, it's only going to work if the judges go along, and I think that's probably true. You don't want to cram something down their throat.
So the mayor's talked about going to this very same state legislature
right.
We were just talking about, and it sounds like Jennifer Joyce is not so sure that she that she wants to go that way. And I think she's probably right that these judges, they seem to think they really run their courts. They don't really like to let people push them around. I noticed it was our friend Judge Durker again who was in the lead in trying to block these.
And what they're going to do is put the gun cases to the top of their docket. I think that's what was.
That's Durker's, what they said they do.
Durker's compromise.
Okay, we'll hear more about that as well. Okay, Andrew, it's time for your question. Thanks for waiting.
Good afternoon. Last month, we saw the threat of U.S. strikes on Syria recede in the wake of a deal reached between the United States, Russia, and Syria. A lot of people are skeptical that this deal might fall through. Do you think if that happens that President Obama will return to Congress, or if he even needs to return to Congress, to obtain authorization to back up the deal with force as he said he's going to do?
Well, I guess what the president will do under the circumstances, I think is sort of a fluid question and really impossible to predict. I mean, obviously his political position, I think, was weakened by the fact that it looked as if that he wasn't going to get the authorization from the House. I think the legal issue that is really interesting, that is implicit in your question, is whether or not legally he had the authority under the Constitution and under the War Powers Act to unilaterally take action. And it's an interesting area, and it's an area where actually two of the greatest Missourians, Harry Truman and Tom Eagleton, ended up being on opposite sides. President Truman in the Korean War really took the position that the president could engage in broad military action without Congress, whereas Senator Eagleton in the War Powers Resolution took a much more limited view. I think basically that the Bush Justice Department took the view that the president's commander-in-chief power gave the president the power to unilaterally commit troops to war. The Eagleton view was that absent authorization, the president could only go to war to defend the country or to defend American troops or people. I think there's been an intermediate position that has been characteristic of most administrations and certainly of the Clinton administration and the Obama administration, which has been that the president can unilaterally take action for a short period of time to vindicate recognized national interests and where the action is going to be limited in scope, duration, and so forth. So that if you're talking about the Iraq war, no, the president needs authorization. But if you're talking about launching a few strikes like we did in Kosovo or in a number of other instances during recent administrations, then the president can probably take action under the War Powers Act for up to 60 days.
And I think Obama clearly believes that. And even though he said, I'm going to go to the Congress, I don't think I'm not reading his mind, but I think legally he would think, I don't have to do that. I was just doing that to kind of make sure we're all on the same page, but I think he'd be able to go over for, like you said, for short strikes.
I mean, I think this is highly unpredictable. I mean, having been foolish enough to predict Supreme Court decisions, I shouldn't compound it by predicting what Obama's going to do, because he surprised me at least twice in the last in this Syria thing. First of all, going to Congress. I mean, I actually think that was not a very smart decision on his part. I think he should have bombed Syria before Labor Day was over. And I think Congress, they would have griped a little bit, and then they would have been just glad they never had a vote on it, and the American people would probably have gone on to other things. And then he surprised me a lot by he's given the speech saying, here's why we have to authorize, why we have to go use force in Syria, and then like in the middle of the speech, he says, he turns to another speech, and suddenly we're doing diplomacy with Russia. And it's not that often that the president will make those sort of, those abrupt changes in direction. So I don't know what Obama will do if this all falls apart with Russia.
I have another case that, who knows, might wind up before the Supreme Court. An appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, has ruled that liking someone on Facebook has First Amendment protection. A lower court judge had ruled that liking on Facebook was insufficient to meet that protection. This involved some sheriff's deputies who apparently on their Facebook page liked a rival to the sheriff in an election. What do you make of this? And is a case like this likely to go all the way up the stairs?
I don't know. I don't know if it'll go to the Supreme Court. I mean, I think it's the last decision's the right decision. So the lower court judge said liking somebody on Facebook wasn't enough. That's not consequential speech. Of course, these people got fired as a result of exactly. just liking, so it had consequences for them. And that's sort of what the appellate court said, is that, let's look at what happened. They lost their jobs. It was an expression of their views concerning the sheriff or whoever it was who was their employer. So I think to say liking is speech is absolutely correct. And I guess I'm sort of guessing it won't go to the Supreme Court just because I think it's sort of obviously the case.
It's like putting a yard sign online. It's the same kind of political speech, and that should be protected. Right?
You know, mentioning the yard sign, that was given as an example. And you all might remember the Ledoux case, Ledoux sign a few years ago. I guess it's now about 15 years ago. Margaret Gillio in Ledoux put a little sign against the Persian Gulf War in her home window, and Ledoux tried to say that made Ledoux look bad. And the Supreme Court unanimously said Margaret Gillio gets to put her sign in the window.
Okay, time is winding down, and I want to get at least one more subject in. Joel, I'll turn to you on this one, and that concerns the recess appointments issue that is before the Supreme Court. There has been a challenge to President Obama's ability to make recess appointments, which, of course, are those appointments made generally involving controversial candidates while the Congress is not in session.
Well, that's an interesting case, and that's the case before the court the presidential power case before the court. And it's interesting because it's an illustration of how constitutional cases sometimes come out of different types of cases. So this is basically a labor case. This is a case where a company has a complaint against an NLRB order that found them at fault for not engaging in collective bargaining. And so their response is to say, well, the NLRB was acting illegally because at the time they were acting, some of the members were people who had been appointed by recess appointments. They hadn't been confirmed by the Senate. The Constitution, of course, says that the president will nominate and, with the advising consent of the Senate, appoint officers, including members of the NLRB. But it provides that the president can make recess appointments during recesses when Congress is out of session. So the issue here is that President Obama appointed the three NLRB members in question during a 3-day recess that the Senate was taking in January of 2012. And the argument is that this wasn't a real recess, that in fact the Senate was pro forma coming into session every day.
We have 30 seconds, Joe.
And that's secondly, that the president can only make appointments during recesses between sessions, not in a session. And finally, that the only time the president can make a recess appointment, the argument is when the vacancy arises during the recess, not when it preexisted. But this should be the major case before the court on presidential power.
As we say in radio, folks, stay tuned for the rest on this one. Our time is up. I want to thank you so much, Joe Goldstein, for being with us. Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith. Give them a round of applause, ladies and gentlemen. Great to do it in this the program in this wonderful venue. We're back in our new old studio, on Monday. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer. Special thanks for today's broadcast goes to Greg Buntenote, Terrence Dupuis, Rich Herberts, Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Phil Donato, Mike Schran, Jennifer Porter, Jeremy Bailey, and Kristen Torres. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. From SLU Law, thanks to Dean Mike Wolf, Matt Gokey, Matt Birmingham, and Julie Orr. St. Louis on the Air is a presentation of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.